Welcome to the Business of Collaboration podcast. In this podcast, we try and answer the following questions. What is innovation? How do people collaborate and work together? Who is behind the most innovative ideas, technology, and knowledge? We are curious about people. How do they innovate? How do they create a new technology or acquire new knowledge? We give them a voice and a platform to share their stories because they are superheroes.
This is Jara Pascual, founder and CEO of Collab With. Today, we are talking to Bianca Rangecroft, co-founder and CEO of Wedding, your digital closet or the Clueless app. We are talking with Bianca about how to design a machine learning algorithm focused on your user needs, how to redesign the way we are doing apps for fashion, how to bootstrap, how to manage the finance inside a startup to think of a decent IPO, and how to mix digitalization, sustainability, and fashion all in one. Do you want to know what it takes to build a successful startup? Learn from the amazing tips and best practices of the CEO and co-founder of Wedding, Bianca Rangecroft. Hi, Bianca. Welcome to the Business of Collaboration podcast.
So excited to be here. Thank you for having me, Jara.
So what is Wedding?
So Wearing is a digital wardrobe that allows you to easily digitize your clothes that results in a streamlined, curatable, accessible virtual styling tool for you. So think online shopping, except it's with your own wardrobe. You receive styling suggestions from us and personalized product recommendations that complete the pieces you already own and love.
So this is like, I remember when we met and we were discussing a lot about this, your app. And I said, well, that's the thing from the 90s, you know, the Clueless film with...
Absolutely.
And it's a Silverstone. Like, this is the, in the morning, you know, like you choose and you check, this is correct, it's matching the things.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, when we first launched, we had Mona May comment on our Instagram post and we were like, this is it, guys. They really love it as much as we do. It was a real homage to both of them, both Alicia and Mona May, when we started creating the app and the Dress Me feature.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because you have this conscious mindset for sustainability, and then you translate this into a very practical digital app to help women to conscious become with fashion. So how do you translate this philosophy, this sustainable philosophy, into a full digital transformation? So why did you create Wearing?
Yeah, so I think that's a really interesting one. So I'll give you a little bit of background on me and why I sort of created it in the first place.
Yeah.
And then kind of how we see that, you know, translate into your daily life. So I guess for me, my background is in banking. I started the first 4 years of my career at Barclays and then at Goldman Sachs in London. And I was in the consumer investment management division at Goldman, which was amazing because I got to work on two big fashion tech IPOs. So Stitch Fix, Katrina Lake is one of my favorite founders. I absolutely adore her and her journey. And also Farfetch, José Neves, again, absolutely amazing guy. And the growth and recovery that he's just pulled off with Farfetch is amazing. And so during that time, I actually did a lot of due diligence into the personal styling landscape, into machine learning and how tech could be sort of leveraged to personalize and curate a shopping experience. And then I thought to myself, well, actually, like, you know, that's really interesting on the purchasing side, but what about utilization? What about this middle of the value chain that no one really thinks about, no one really deals with or talks about? And the consumer is kind of left there with all these clothes and they don't really know what to do with them, right? We constantly buy more. We're in this vicious cycle. And so that's when the idea of Wearing kind of came to me, because I was like, I have this profound desire to democratize personal styling and bring it to the masses, right? It shouldn't be something that women who have, you know, hundreds of thousands of euros in salary are able to afford. What about all the students? What about the young women out there who are just starting to create their wardrobe, right? And so that also led me to do a lot of research into the impact space and how we could use innovation for impact. And basically the mission there was really just to fundamentally change the way we interact with our clothes and kind of upend this throwaway culture. So I guess for me, the inspiration, bring back to what you're saying about how we can harness innovation, for me was just, you know, the system is broken. As I said, there's this vicious cycle of not being able to see what you own. So that was the biggest part of the innovation for us, was bringing it digital. The impulse buying, where I still felt like I was never quite getting it right. Sometimes I'd buy things that worked, sometimes they didn't. And then the lack of inspiration in the styling process itself. And for me, that only meant one thing. As I said, we have to take this digital and we have to harness the power of machine learning to hyper-personalize our entire fashion experience, not just the purchasing side of the value chain.
Yeah, totally. I mean, like, this was super cool and sometimes as well complex how you can personalize styling an app. And at the same time, keeping the mindset of green, you know, how to be sustainable in your daily choices. So what is for you a sustainable wardrobe and a conscious buying?
I love that question so much. So I think there are a couple of things at play here. I think for me, as I said, I'll take the second part first. So the conscious buying, I guess for me, is all about being able to see what you own and buying things to fill your wardrobe gaps, right? Like, what are the things you need to be able to unlock more outfits in your wardrobe? What are the things that you need that you can invest in, buy for quality, and that you're going to keep and love and even create an emotional attachment to in the long term? So for me, those were all the kind of considerations that were at play there. And then the last thing at play in terms of those purchasing decisions was, what's my style? Do I even know what I like? Do I even know who I stand for? And as you said, it's a very difficult thing to get right. And so we did a lot of work on a huge amount of understanding the user journey, understanding user behaviors. We did a lot in the product discovery phase around the product recommendations into what do women actually feel is their style and what is right for them. And so we honed down on that and we built a style quiz that informs our product recommendations. And that was another sort of form of innovation of how could we essentially streamline these questions to make sure that you'd get an answer that felt real. And it wasn't an answer that put you into like, you're a classical girl, but that said, actually, maybe you're a classical girl 57%. And then, you know, the rest, you're actually a minimalist. And we have this split personality, right? And sometimes it even changes with seasons, with periods in your life. And so we're trying to pay a lot of attention to that. And that really informs how we should buy. And so what I mean is like, you know, a student buys certain things. Someone in her early 30s is in a different phase of her life. A mom is in another phase of her life. And so that was all really crucial to sort of visualizing the way that we created and deal with the product recommendations. And then to answer the question of all questions, what does a sustainable wardrobe look like? I think there are a couple of things at play here. So I think first of all, for me, it's being able to see everything that you own. It's being able to interact with everything that you own and have this almost intentional, I mean, at Wearing on social, we joke about it a lot, but we refer to something called wardrobe yoga. It's like, how can you hold these pieces? How can you be intentional with them? How can you use them in different poses? So it's a bit of a metaphor just to say that for us, it's really about learning to cherish everything that you have, loving the clothes that are ready in your wardrobe, and thinking about how you can mix them up. So whether that is with personal styling, with a tool like Wearing that suggests, auto-suggests looks for you that you hadn't thought of, whether it's asking your friends, whether it's periodically putting things away and then bringing them out and getting that newness fix like that. Because we're very visual, we're very tactile humans. Sometimes it's just a question of, you know, reshuffling things and then coming back to them. And then the last piece of what is a sustainable wardrobe for me is, as we said before, it's about buying the right things for you. And something that plays a lot into that are trends like, how can we rent certain things that we don't want to own, but that play a role in our journey? How can we buy things that are pre-loved? There are a lot of amazing companies out there, you know, the Vestiaires, not to mention, you know, the Depops, the eBays, et cetera. How can wearing create, you know, edits for you that are tailored to you? And so many other avenues that you can sort of explore, whether it's repurposing your things, et cetera. But I think all of this requires some sort of consciousness. And that's what we're trying to do at Wearing, is really educate you on all those different levels. And I'm kind of going through that journey myself, signing up to like repurposing and DIY, you know, events for Valentine's Day and stuff like that. So yeah, I think that's a sustainable wardrobe for me.
Yeah, totally. I think when you were answering, it came to my mind a lot of cases, no? When you are not dressing the same way during the week, like in the weekends, you know, like, and then you have to train your app, like, how you are wearing in the weekends, you know? And yeah. And as well in the part of, like, you change through your life. And this was a very critical point for a stylist, you know, how you change from your college years to now more professional, and then you get up in the hierarchy, so you have to dress up completely different. And sometimes some women, they miss the point, like they have to change the t-shirt and jeans from the college to maybe a more high quality t-shirt and jeans when you are growing up. So this is super helpful. I think it's a life saver, I think, for everyone.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I agree. And I actually struggled with that a lot personally myself, even as I transitioned from kind of banking, where, you know, at GS, we used to wear heels, black suits, you know, a little silk scarf and try and look very chic and very, you know, underplayed and really play into the stereotype of the professional woman, whatever that meant. And now, you know, transitioning into a fashion founder, I mean, look what I'm wearing today, you know, a Ghani leopard, you know, top. And I'm trying to be more creative. I'm trying to unleash this version 2.0 of Bianca. And it is actually really difficult. Actually, at the beginning of this year, when I was doing my January wardrobe clean out, you know, looking at what I owned, I sort of thought to myself, well, I don't even know how to best go about this. Like, I need Wearing to say to me, look, here are a lot of the pieces you can keep those power suits, but add in, you know, a really colorful, you know, top, something that takes us to the next level. Swap your heels for some trainers. Like, there's a lot that you could already do to leverage your existing wardrobe. And here's how we accompany you in that transition, because it's a very stressful one. Mm. And I think the other thing that came to mind just now as we were talking about that, which could be a great idea for a new thing for Wearing to do as a collaboration, is how do we ethically donate as we go through these life cycles, to not to just a charity that takes that and reprocesses it, but how do we donate it to people who are actually entering that life cycle? There must be a way where we can streamline that, right?
Yeah, because you have already in the algorithm the profile, a styling profile of every member you have. So you know exactly who will use it.
Correct.
You know, like in this sense, sometimes when I am buying secondhand vintage in Bestiaire Collective, sometimes I think, that's super cool, and then when it goes home, I say, like, oh my god, I will never
wear this. Yeah.
So, you know, like, I think it could be a very useful add-on to Bestiaire as well.
Absolutely.
But I had the same question like you, like, becoming an entrepreneur, I said, like, I cannot dress like before incorporate.
I completely agree.
Yeah, I don't know how, and this is maybe some kind of maybe collaboration we can do about a styling or something. How should dress a woman entrepreneur?
Yeah, yeah. No, I love that. And I think it's actually a question that I got asked the other day in another interview, was how do we think about the 30 wears, you know, rule when we're running a fashion business, and every time you're on an IG live, you need to look new, you need to look fresh. You may even need like, you know, a latest piece from one of the, you know, the brands that you're onboarding. So, I mean, for us, it was also really hard just sort of towing that line, right? Between we're preaching sustainability on the one side, and how can we use a tool like Wearing to actually maximize our creativity rather than just buy to fit into this new persona that I've created for myself, now a founder, you know?
Wearing is this personal stylist app, but you are doing it with machine learning and AI. How is this possible? What do you have in mind, you know, to train the algorithm?
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's a great question. We thought a lot about the stylist proposition, and that's still potentially on the cards. I think, you know, for now, it's just not going to inform the current kind of Dress Me function and Wearing app. It's not going to inform the styling recommendations that we give our wearers, but it might be an add-on feature where we allow stylists to onboard, you know, their clients to the Wearing app so that we can, you know, piggyback on that digital transformation aspect, but that sort of stays in its own kind of, you know, B2B service offering that we provide as a company. But then coming back to what we actually do in app now for our current wearers, the logic behind what we're doing at the moment is quite simple. So we started out with some very basic kind of hard-coded rules where we would say, okay, we exclude things. So, you know, this type of pant doesn't go with this type of blouse. This coat is long and therefore, you know, we wouldn't pair it with a skirt that's a little bit longer. Otherwise it's going to look weird. You know, that kind of stuff. We started off really basic. And also, like, obviously we won't pair trainers, you know, with something that doesn't go with that. So that was kind of the basic level. And now, as we've seen a big uptick in user growth and user engagement, we've said, all right, now we've crossed the barrier, you know, of 50,000 items being uploaded to Wearing. We're starting to get critical mass in terms of the number of outfits created, the number of pieces uploaded. And so now the machine learning algorithm can become much more self-sustaining and can really learn on its own. And so what we're introducing now is a thumbs down, thumbs up kind of scheme, where every time we recommend an outfit to you, you kind of can say, okay, love that. No, that wasn't quite right. I don't like skirts with, you know, with trainers. That's just not my vibe. And so we would sort of start to understand that and then replicate the outfits that you've already created with different pieces. So now it's all about this validated learning phase, where we need the data to scale. We need to understand you. The more we know about you, the better. You know, without treading on your footsteps, we're not selling it to anyone. It's really just to be able to provide a better service for you at the moment.
Yeah, totally. And this is one of the critical points of AI. How is the moment they learn from your behavior in non-intrusive way? Yeah, very good. So you are coming from a financial background. You were working on IPOs, like you mentioned, in the fashion industry. How does this background helping you now with your startup, Wearing? How do you manage your finances and how you are bootstrapping?
Yes, I think I'm going to take the end of that first and then come back to the first part of the question. I love doing this. I don't know why. So I think in terms of the bootstrapping and the managing our finances, I mean, I think it was a very difficult journey for us so far because, you know, as we've just explored, it's a very complex product. And as you're kind of negotiating, you know, with investors, you're trying to secure a valuation that's going to protect you as you grow and you go through your seed, you know, your pre-seed seed and series A rounds, you know, you really need to keep that dilution in mind. And for us, you know, now the magic number was really like, okay, we can't exceed a 25%, you know, equity contribution for this first and second round, because then we're not eligible for series A. So keeping that in mind, we were kind of working backwards from that and saying, well, you know, what's the milestone that we need to get to at that point? How can we achieve that now? How do we price our round now to make sure that we have enough cash for 18 months to sort of make that happen? And then work back from that and say, well, if we bootstrap a little bit longer, if we're able to, I'm not saying remortgage the house, but you know, take on a little bit more personal risk because we believe in this, ultimately we'll be better off if this does, you know, take off. So I think there was some kind of, you know, embedded risk appetite in me because I had been exposed to a lot of these things, challenging the gender stereotype once more. I know women are usually more cautious.
I don't know. Maybe that's a stereotype.
I think so too. I think we just think about it more and we're just more informed when we make those decisions. So for me, it was a very conscious decision to say, you know, I can't afford to use my savings from Goldman to really go at this with everything that I have. And it was interesting because I do think that my financial literacy in that perspective helped, because it made me think that it's better to go all in and fail fast and not waste more time, rather than kind of say, let me take it slow. You know, let's be less aggressive in our growth path. Let's do less and just be more cautious and make sure that, you know, it's safe to proceed. So I think that was for me the most interesting part. My team and I, we've bootstrapped totally. So the co-founders, we've put in everything that we have. Hako, our CTO, basically built the entire MVP himself without any help. So that was sweat equity to the max. And he really rocked it. So thank you. Yeah, we again, you know, very funny because our COO is also an ex-banker, so we had a lot of kind of, you know, memes circulating about working hard, you know, investment banking hours, etc. But then I think on the financial side, you know, as I said, we've been really cautious with our cash flow. We've really made sure that, you know, we have enough runway. We, again, as I'm sure a lot of businesses do, underestimated our runway. You know, we got featured in a couple of articles. We had 2,000 downloads in a day that converted to 1,500 active users just off that piece of content. And so that's why you need to be really, really careful, really conservative in your forecast, because thank God we had enough money to bridge the gap. But had we not planned for it, you know, we would have been in a really tough situation. And that's especially when you're on the cusp of, I don't want to say product market fit, but, you know, quasi product market fit is an early stage company. It's important that you don't mess it up, right? Because if you have to say to users, I'm sorry, we can't deal, we don't have the money to pay our suppliers, you can't be on the platform. That's the worst case scenario, right? So I think that kind of answers those two questions. And then the stuff that I kind of took away from Goldman that really helped me in my journey, just more broadly, I think knowing what you don't know is probably the most valuable realization that I had as an early stage founder. And that was very much ingrained in the Goldman culture. So that ability to surround yourself with subject matter experts, you know, back in the day for me, that was the equity solutions group. It was the investment bank, certain teams that I had to speak to all the time. I didn't have all the knowledge. And I think that kind of attitude is just really, really helpful, especially when you don't necessarily have experience in the field, right? I'm not a fashion founder. I mean, I am, but I don't have experience in that domain. And then I think the other thing that's really, really interesting is also just being a team player. Because I see this a lot, especially with female founders, you know, we work very, very hard. There's a lot of talk about mental health, etc. And I think at GS, you know, the single most powerful thing of that culture was being a team player and knowing how to take a hit for the team, help someone, even if it's, you know, quarter to midnight on a Tuesday, you need to help your COO do something, you do it. Whatever you can do to make sure that person can get ahead in their pillar and can make whatever they need to make happen is super powerful. So we've been very collaborative, and that's, I know, a theme that you love and sort of uphold with every fiber of your being.
Yeah, but I think even Bianca, I think like you can teach other women about all these financial tricks, you know, like how to know and how to calculate the percentage of equity you have to give away to be still relevant when you have an IPO. This is not a normal knowledge I think founders know, and to master this financial investment knowledge, I think it takes time. So if you have someone, I think, to help you to understand, you know, with the tricks and knowing, like, you are a founder as well, you know, someone who has no idea about entrepreneurship, telling you all the things is a completely different story. So we were discussing number of users versus organic growth versus loyalty and the impact of a busy investment in the business. So what is your mindset?
Yeah, I think that's a super, super interesting question. And I think it's actually something that we've thought about and toyed with a lot. And it's, I think it's sometimes not easy when you first start out to visualize and understand all of this. As you said, there's a lot of learning that has to happen in terms of, as you said, what are the requirements? How does fundraising work? How do I, you know, set those goals that I talked about before and sort of then, you know, work backwards to what you need to do now to get to them later in the future. And I think we spent a lot of time thinking about our exits. And I know this sounds weird, but we were thinking about, and it's something we discussed the other day together, you know, what do you want for your business? What is it that you're trying to build? Because I think that will then inform how you go about, you know, setting up certain safeguards, how you go about certain efforts like marketing, like growth. Right. And so for us, obviously, we, you know, two bankers, the first thing that came to mind was we want to IPO, we want to do a trade sale. Like, this is going to be a big thing. We have huge plans for Wearing, you know, whether it's on the B2B side, the data side, there's so much that we could, you know, do and grow this business into. So I think looking at that, we then thought, okay, well, obviously, we need VC money, right? And we really wanted to fight this, you know, WeWork model where you don't need to monetize. For us, you know, we really wanted to focus on how can we have paying customers? How can we move people up the funnel? There has to be a way, whether it's on the product recommendation side, on the freemium model where you have subscription for the premium features, whether it's, you know, different B2B integrations. We want to model all of this. We want to test it really quickly and we want to make sure it works. And that's how we approached the idea of VC investment, because we were thinking, it doesn't make sense for us to just take on a lot of cash to validate assumptions that we don't even know are true. So we want to postpone that VC thing. We want to make sure that we do that when we have really tested these things and we can, you know, as I said before, negotiate a better valuation, make sure that, you know, we're really standing up for what we've done so far and have, you know, users or data to show for that. And so coming back from all of that, well, we decided firstly that we wanted to do a freemium model. Because on the one hand, we wanted to see this explosion in user growth, even if it was at the free level, because as we said, that informs the machine learning, which is crucial to the product itself, which is even more important for the paid version of the product. So for us, we're very, very keen on getting a lot of users onboarded on the program, on the app. And then thinking about organic growth and loyalty, it was an interesting one, and we really struggled and had, you know, various debates around this, because obviously the beginning of Wearing was all organic. Like, what we've seen so far, you know, nearly 10,000 downloads after only being live for, you know, 2 or 3 months basically, is absolutely amazing. And that was all organic. We spent a lot of time on, you know, newsletters, getting featured, getting mentioned, getting girlfriends to talk to other girlfriends, etc. And so for us, it's a no-brainer that that's going to stay very top of mind in our marketing efforts. And so we're going to do a lot around referrals, a lot around ambassador programs. We're going to think a lot about not doing the top tier influencer stuff, but actually the more real, you know, micro influencer level, because to us that makes sense, because this is a product for a woman by a woman. And we don't want it to feel too, you know, too salesy. So for us, that loyalty component is really, really important. And we've had, you know, these 10,000, you know, downloads, these 10,000 wearers that have really informed the way we build the product, and we want that to stay that way. So that loyalty thing is really important for us. But yeah, as you said, I think now we're at a stage where we really have to ramp up growth. We have to pay much more attention to digital marketing, because if we do want to secure that VC investment, we already know, you know, they want 50,000 monthly active users by the end of this year from us, which is super, super tough. So yeah, we're having a bit of a struggle now thinking about all the ways in which we can deploy the cash that we raise to ensure that we get to those levels for us to be actually interesting for VCs. And yeah, it's a whole other debate whether some of this is reasonable. and whether it's in the best interest of your business. But yeah, these are the things that we're thinking about.
Yeah, that's always the question. Because from VC money, they want you to grow quickly, but then you are losing the part of the loyalty as well of the users, or to focus as well on making work the machine and the operations.
Yeah, I agree. And I think it comes back to what I was saying before about, you know, for us, if we raise $500,000 now, let's say it would be very easy for us to just pump all that money into digital ads that we know work because we've done a lot of growth hacking. And then basically arrive at a point in 18 months where we spent all that money and we say, well, actually, you know what? We should have gone after this other business model that was much more important than the subscription. Maybe our users are just not going to, this is not the thing that's going to make us. And so that's what I'm very wary of at the moment, is making sure that when we do raise, we're testing multiple things to make sure that we're not wasting time, just as you said, spending all the money on growth at all costs without really experimenting and staying lean and staying super alert as a business.
Yeah, totally. That's one of the key of success, I think, in the short and long term.
Indeed.
So how are you doing marketing and PR? Because you mentioned you are working with micro influencers, but you have at the same time in Instagram and everywhere in the website, super modern, avant-garde graphic design. So how was your approach?
Yeah, I love this question so much. It's so core to our identity.
Yeah.
And I think as a founder, you know, we often box ourselves into these like, you know, stereotypes. Like for me, I was the ex-banker, you know, who wanted to have more shoes in my closet than stocks in my portfolio, you know, blah, 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 all these jokes. That was kind of my identity. But when we started wearing, for me, I was predominantly like a consumer. I want this product. This is my dream product, and I'm obsessed with the problem itself. And one of the things that a lot of the existing wardrobe organizers in the market have that I really disliked was branding. You know, they just weren't doing it for me. It wasn't an app that I wanted to open all the time. The Instagram wasn't giving me value as a consumer. Yeah. It was just throwing ads at me or just telling me what the product does. And so I was super lucky that my first hire was a brand and marketing specialist, and she has been with us since day one, and she's just basically amazing.
Yes,
and
she's amazing.
She's amazing. She's young and like kicking my ass. So I think there's really something to be said for that, you know, young graduate who's super hungry and whose creativity is just overflowing. Mm-hmm. And so Amelia and I made it our mission to kind of make sure that wearing as a product, as a brand, has this tone of a best friend and this look and feel of a heritage brand. Like that's what we wanted, and we thought it was really important. And so our tone of voice is very cheeky. It's very, you know, modern. As you say, it's really for the modern woman. And then I guess thinking a little bit about customer acquisition, you know, we were trying to be quite creative, quite different. And so, you know, we're looking at things, like I mentioned, the micro influencers who are genuine, who are creative, who are full of color, you know, women who are, we actually call them the women of wearing. So we're doing a whole campaign around, you know, who are you? Are you, is she a cook? Does she work in a restaurant? Is she a PR executive? Is she a consultant? Does she work in the EU Parliament? Who is this girl? Because we all have these amazing multifaceted personalities, and we wanted our marketing and PR to showcase that, because wearing is for everyone, and it needs to sort of be like that. And then I think, you know, we've done a lot of like guerrilla marketing. Like in London, we used to go and sit in Oxford Street with like a banner and kind of hand out these like QR codes to girls. And they were all like, oh my God, this branding is amazing.
Yeah.
And so we're looking at doing like a wearing branded, you know, bus, taxis, like billboards in London. Like that's the next thing for us. going back to a little bit of physical marketing, which we think would work really well for us as a brand. So yeah, I guess we've just tried to do very creative, weird things that have worked for us. And we, before COVID, we actually did an amazing pop-up in a virtual digital space in London, which we love because that feels exactly like what wearing stands for. And so that's another thing. We were going to do these weekly pop-ups. We were going to partner with Depop resellers. So we've got a lot of ideas around that, and we're trying to be very different.
Yeah, super cool. That's one of the things. I think, yeah, that's super cool. You know, when you have your own business and you can do whatever you want with.
Exactly.
That's the, you know, like super cool. And if you have all this creativity and say, no, we will change everything how the others are doing, you know, this kind of super passion and power and energy you get from, you know, from wanting to go with your purpose, but as well to change the status quo.
Yeah.
It's like you are doing the 360 degrees, and that's the super amazing.
You are listening to the Business of Collaboration podcast, a production from CollabWith. We are an online community helping businesses connect with experts to solve innovation challenges and create consortiums. We do this through a custom-built environment where academics, startups, and businesses collaborate to innovate and accelerate. Together, we break down the barrier between academics and the business world. Innovation has never been so accessible. And now, back to our podcast.
So now going back to almost the basic questions.
Yeah.
What is innovation for you?
What a question. I feel like I'm back at Imperial in my studying days.
But you are doing innovation.
My favorite professor used to ask us that all the time. Exactly. No, exactly. I mean, look, I think for me, it's actually very simple. And I'll take the example of what I was saying before. I'm predominantly a user, right? I identified this niche in the market. There was no product that really fit me. I didn't have, none of their identities matched mine. Maybe the values did, but again, they weren't talking to me in the right way. It wasn't pulling me in. And so I think for me, innovation is a couple of things. First of all, very simply, you're either harnessing technology or harnessing a force for good that is new. And then you may just be revisiting or revamping something that already exists, but putting your unique spin on it. And I think, honestly, there's so much talk about entrepreneurship has to be this idea that no one's ever thought of, completely reinventing the wheel. And for me, that's not it at all. That's actually very rare, right? So for me, it's really just about looking at an existing product and thinking, how can I improve that? How can I talk directly to the audience who's going to buy into this product? And how can I improve and be novel with my ideas of acquisition, of marketing, of brand identity, and above all, of engagement? Because those are really the rules of the game.
Yeah, totally. And this is a very good point. Like, innovation is not invention. First point.
Exactly.
Innovation is not only technology, you know, science fiction going to the moon all the time. I think that's a very good reminder.
No, I agree. And actually, I was on a webinar today with one of our accelerators in London. And one of the panelists talked about, you know, the famous quote from Henry Ford saying, you know, if I had asked people what they wanted, they would have said they wanted faster horses. So I think for me, it's innovation is also about understanding what the user truly wants. It's about really spending time on those pain points and coming up with something that's innovative, yet just practical enough for someone to get hooked on. Yeah. So I think those are kind of the things we live by at Wearing.
Mm-hmm. And what is collaboration for innovation?
Even better question. So I think, again, one of the things that I used to sort of struggle with a little bit when I was in banking was everything was very siloed. Like, you were in banking, you talked to traders, you had your friends who you used to talk about the markets with, and that was it, right? And I think the best thing for me, again, not to bash that, I completely love that and I miss that and I invest my own money, so I do miss those conversations. But basically, one of the best things about entrepreneurship for me was when I arrived in this field and I thought, oh my goodness, you know, cross-pollination, first of all, is incredible. Like, I could be talking to a founder in the FMCG space And she or he could be saying to me, well, you know what, we've done this, like this is an interesting growth hack. This is how we've thought about this. And so much of that knowledge is applicable. So I think first and foremost, for me, it's innovation and collaboration is around breaking down the boundaries of industry and looking at, you know, what you're doing at a topical level. What are the sort of best practices? What are the shared, you know, tips and innovative ideas that might be applicable in some way, shape or form for your own business? And then I think the second thing for me is, and you know, we're still early days in this, but it's collaboration through, you know, marketing loops or through, you know, just collaborating at a product level. A lot of startups don't do this enough. And I think we're just catching on to this now. How can you leverage the ecosystem? How can you leverage people that are around you that are non-threatening competitors and actually collaborate with them for impact and scale? Because a lot of the time, and we're coming back to the VC point and the investor point, you know, they're expecting this of you. How do you get there all by yourself? Sometimes cash is not enough. Sometimes it's about leveraging communities. Sometimes it's about leveraging, you know, female entrepreneur friends who you can get on a panel. You know, it doesn't have to be complicated, but I think there's so much out there if you just reach out and extend an olive branch. And I think that's a really interesting, you know, an amazing aspect of this, you know, working from home digital culture. You can do so much more now at the click of a button. So yeah. Highly recommend.
What is collab with for you?
Oh, I love this one. I mean, I think a couple of things, and I could go on here, but I think for me, it's about having a platform where everything that I just talked about can happen in a streamlined way. Because I think, you know, speaking as an entrepreneur, sometimes it's super overwhelming. Like you're on Instagram, you're seeing all these different businesses. Oh, I could partner with them. I could do this. And, you know, sometimes it's just so overwhelming. So I think for me, having a forum where you can be matched, you can, you know, reach out and say, I'm looking for this. Here's my problem. Can you, you know, hook me up with students who want a case study? How can we also do this reverse mentoring? How can I speak to, you know, thought leaders in the industry? You know, one of the things that I'm so grateful to you for, but, you know, you getting us onto, you know, a panel where we talked about how we could shift, you know, mindsets and investment, you know, for female founders and female run businesses in the European, you know, space. For me, it's access to that kind of thing. It's access to webinars where you get so much meat and so much kind of info from. And again, I think it's just the power of the platform. And that makes so much sense to me, especially as an early stage founder.
Yeah, totally. I think that's the beauty of creating a niche platform, or could be a community for any kind of topic. Like, you structure the way the community can perform.
I love that word, perform. It's so important, and it's true, because a lot of communities that I've been in / you know, seen are very transactional based, and sometimes you don't get much out of it. But that word perform really means everything to me. I think you're completely right.
So now we are going to the personal questions, Bianca.
Yay, exciting.
So, to the good ones. So what is the thing you are most proud of?
Personally or for wearing?
Yeah. Personal question.
Personal question, damn it. Okay. Sorry. I think for me, it's the fact that I come from a background where my parents, especially my father, worked very, very hard. So it's like the South African, you know, put your nose down culture. You do it, you'll be successful. You just have to persevere. And I think for me, when I left school, I then went to study history and politics. I specialized in Africa and the Middle East. I wanted to be an emerging market specialist. And then I did a degree in business, and I went into finance, into economics, something I had never studied, you know, even at school. Those weren't my majors. And then I got a job in banking, you know, in one of the most competitive environments in the world. And I was, you know, a woman, like, you know, and I hadn't done any previous internships, and it was hard, and I made it happen. And then I went into fashion. And so I think for me, that thing is just adaptability. It's being a quick learner. I think that for me is the thing that I'm most proud of, because somehow resilience and you know, the power to adapt got me through all this and got me to do the things I wanted to do in life. So sometimes it's not just about the skills or the knowledge. You can build that. You can almost fake it till you make it. You just have to put your nose down.
So, and the failure you were learning the most from?
Oh, that's a tough one. I think maybe just taking this back to wearing for a sec. I think for me, it was just the fact that you really have to get into this lean mindset. And I know it's such a cliche, but I think for me, every time we run product discovery, every time we think about a new feature, we think about something new, we really try to remind ourselves to go through that whole process. Like, what are the pains of the customer? What are the jobs to be done? Because I think at the beginning, for instance, we spent a lot of money, you know, getting a first designer to do the app. We knew exactly what we wanted. We were kind of replicating a bit what was out there, and we were thinking, okay, the branding is going to be the whole difference. I know that sounds really silly, but you very quickly fall into this trap of, I know exactly what I want. I'm obsessed with my product, and I'm just going to bring that to fruition. And we did that. We spent all this money. It was devastating. Thank God we didn't build it, but you know, I had a conversation with my CTO and we said, look, this is not good enough. The UX here is not innovative. It's not different. And we have to start from scratch. And we did that. But in that failure, you know, I really learned to say, well, okay, every single time we do this, we will stay true to this lean methodology. We're going to test it with as many people as possible and make sure that we're really building something people want. And we're transforming the way they use the product.
Yeah, totally. And I think that's a very good example, because if you see as a startup a huge difference from corporate, is this. Maybe the corporate, they forget to talk to the user. Even the agencies of digitalization, they are having ideas in a brainstorming or in their minds and forgetting if this is even useful for the ecosystem. So I think this is how, as a startup, you can be very proud of at the same time and say, hey, I have something I can teach, you know, like this way of working.
Yeah.
So what is your favorite place for holidays?
I have to say Italy. Italy has my heart. So my mom named me Bianca, obviously, because I'm the whitest person she'd ever seen. But also because she had fallen in love with Italy, same as me. And every summer we used to go back to this place called Elba, the island of Elba. And I think that's just stolen my heart forever. And when I have kids, I will take them back there. It's just a magical place.
How are your mornings look like? Do you have a routine in the morning?
Oh, yes, definitely. So I think the first thing that I do is I wake up with something called a Lumi light, which is something that wakes you up with natural light. So you have this progressive wake up, which I really, really like. It reminds me of, you know, waking up in Africa where the sun would wake you up. And it just felt very just natural, I think. And I think after that, I actually have a little gratitude journal, and it's almost like a meditative quote that you look at and then you sort of write your thoughts around it. So, you know, it could be something like, what are your values and how do you live intentionally to uphold them? But it's just a short book page, and I write that every morning. And I think that helps me just feel a little bit grounded. And then I must say, I'm one of those people who needs that morning coffee. Otherwise, I am not the best version of myself. But after that, I sit down at my desk. I usually put on some kind of candle or maybe humidifier with essential oils. And then I sometimes rub essential oils on my palms or on my wrists and also my temples. One that helps me kind of, that motivates me to just get stuff done during the day. And I found that that works really well for me.
What are you doing with your spare time on the weekends?
I wish I had a better answer for you, but I think I do a lot of work on the weekends. I was just tweeting yesterday at 10:45. I was like, how did the female founders in this space do it? Because I am struggling with burnout a little bit. No, but seriously, I think I love to walk. So for me, the spare time is trying to just give my brain that downtime to think. I think one of the most difficult things of running your own business is being able to take a step back, look at it, reevaluate things. So when I walk, I try and do that. I listen to podcasts. I always find that very inspiring. Yours, obviously, is one of my top ideas. And then I think I used to say chess. I've completely given that up, unfortunately. And I try to read as much as possible. And yeah, I think that's it. Cooking also features there from time to time when I have time.
What is last question? So what is your favorite music?
Jara, you're going to laugh so much when I tell you. Carlos Vives.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I love anything reggaeton. I love like more traditional music from Colombia, like all these places. And I also really like classical music. Mm-hmm. Yeah, which I listen to when I work. I find it very peaceful.
Yeah. So now we are at the end, and I would like to ask you if you have some kind of a statement or something you want to share with the audience.
I mean, I think, guys, not to be too salesy, but I really, really believe that sometimes you just need to do less thinking and more wearing. So I think for me, that means just making sure you're super conscious and intentional with what you own, buy only the things that you want, and really think about what your legacy is going to be in the fashion space. You know, are you going to try and do better? We're all recovering hypocrites, but taking a small step today to being more intentional, more mindful, whether it's with your utilization or your consumption, I think is a great way to end this podcast.
Thank you very much, Bianca.
Thanks so much for having me. This was such a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to the Business of Collaboration podcast. And remember, if you want to support what we do, then share, subscribe, and leave a review over on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, and Google Podcasts. You can find a summary of this podcast at podcast.collabwave.org. See you next week.